This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Beneath the Truth and Movies. Today, war for the Planet of the Apes. Circus goes to town as Weta Studios render Caesar in epic tale of guerrilla warfare. And getting legless on the Southern Comfort, it's Sofia Coppola's The Beguiled. Plus, Film Club, we try Max My Love, the movie, not the internet pill offer. It's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Blimey. Well, hello there, everybody, and thanks for joining us for another edition of Truth and Movies. Very excited to have with us today Manuela Lazic.
Hello.
Hi, Manuela. Hello. Who's the twin sister of Elena, who you probably heard on last week's podcast.
That's right.
Right. That's so fascinating. Identical twins, and you do identical work.
Yeah, we're both film critics. We both studied film at university, and yeah, it just kind of happened.
Do you ever disagree violently about films between yourselves?
And yeah? That's when it's more interesting. It's great.
Okay.
But it's like, it makes for really good conversations, and I think it's a good exercise.
Okay.
So I feel really lucky.
And you also only need one press pass for film festivals.
Well, one time we had to use our genetical similarity to get into a festival, but since then we've been recognized as two separate human beings, so we now have two passes.
Outstanding. Congratulations for that,
Manuela. Thank you.
Adam Woodward.
Hi.
Very much your own entity.
Yep.
Good to have you with us today as we prepare to discuss some very, very interesting and some fabulous looking films. We'll talk about how much more they do than look fabulous. If you want to get in touch, we'll be looking at one or two of your comments later on, then you certainly can do via email at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. Or on Twitter at LW Lies, or Facebook, just the Little White Lies Facebook page. How's the actual podcast homepage getting along?
It's getting there.
Is it? All right, super.
ETA is not confirmed, but it's on its way.
All right.
Actually, if I may, I'd just like to kick us off with a fun fact this week, because I know you love those. We're talking about Baby Driver and Okja the other week. A friend of mine got in touch to say that he'd watched Snowpiercer. And apparently, according to him anyway, I haven't actually verified this myself, but apparently Jamie Bell's character in Snowpiercer was named after Edgar Wright.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. He's named Edgar.
He's named Edgar, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I still haven't seen Snowpiercer because David's hoarding the one copy that we have.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, looking forward to that. All right, well, we're going to kick off today with War for the Planet of the Apes.
I did not start this.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Andy Serkis there as Caesar, kind of channeling a little bit of Sylvester Stallone. They drew First Blood in the third part of this rebooted trilogy of Planet of the Apes, courtesy of director Matt Reeves, as this struggle between human survivors of simian flu and Caesar's Apes Coalition, as their struggle reaches a climax. Adam?
Do you know what? Someone should make a remake, First Blood, with a monkey in the lead role. I think I would want to see that.
If they already hadn't.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be that different, though.
No.
Mm. Okay, so general consensus on the War for the Planet of the Apes is that it's the best of the three films so far. What did you think?
Yeah, the third in the prequel series, which takes place, I think, about 15 years after Rise, which is the first one. Confusingly, Dawn and Rise, I think they kind of got that the wrong way around. And
well, it depends. They got up before Dawn.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Is it the Rise before the Dawn?
Right, it can be, and now here's the War. But anyway, what did you think of this film then?
The War itself, the sort of titular War, it takes a little while to kind of get going. It's a film which I think opens with this amazing sort of 20-minute or so sequence where you're immersed in this ape world in the kind of forest where we left them before. And ends up ultimately with the war unfolding, and in the middle I think it sags a little bit, but the premise is that Caesar is essentially trying to end the conflict between the humans. We find out that the humans have been decimated by the simian flu, and there's a sort of gathering of them in an isolated old military facility in California.
I think it's probably a bit further north than that.
Is it a bit further north?
Yeah, I think so. Up near the border, they
say. On the western seaboard of America. And the humans have got sort of actually bigger problems than the apes, as we find out.
Yeah. Okay, it looks amazing. You mentioned the opening sequence and that skirmish at the start, which is extraordinary to look at. Did it do more than just excite you visually, Manuela?
I think it is. The fact that it's exciting visually is one of its most interesting attributes, because it's not just exciting visually. I found that the style was really classical. It kind of looked like a Western sometimes, but not in a Logan way. Like, I think it really looked like a Western. Like, the way the shots were constructed, they were really composed. There was great tension in the images. For instance, there's this image where the apes are looking into a sort of cave and scared of what's going to come. And they're, you know, it's a parallel shot to them, and it's really just really intense and really scary. I thought it was so, so gripping for that. And that's not something I didn't find in the previous film by Matt Reeves, the other Planet of the Apes movie, Dawn. So I don't know what happened there, but it's really, really striking.
Well, there's actually an interesting article with him on Den of Geek, their website, where he talks specifically about the fact that he was able to, with the new technology, with the cameras he used and having done Dawn, that he was able to actually map things out in the right order, whereas previously he'd had a lot of the CGI done and then had to kind of retrofit his actual shots to it.
Oh, that explains.
So he's really very, very proud of the way that this looks. He's gone for an epic, almost biblical feel to the film at times.
Totally. Like, and my sister, actually, Elena, who was on this podcast last week, she said that she has this theory that maybe the reason why the shots are so beautifully composed is because the CGI is so, so precise that they had to take time to look at each frame. And that's why the monkeys look so real. And so because they had time to look at each frame, they had time to compose them so well. And I think that makes it so much better than most blockbusters where there's loads of CGI.
Right. I don't know if you caught Transformers, whatever it was.
I caught one of them.
Right. But we were talking here about the number of edits per second in that film. This is so measured by
it's
comparison.
It's so patient. And so you get to really see all the details of the CGI, but not just in a superficial look at how good we are at this thing way. It's really, it just makes the film so much better. And you get the sense that those apes are real characters, like real apes. I was going to say real people, but not people.
Well, we should talk a bit about the people behind the apes. Steve Zahn entering the cast list here with Bad Ape, and an interesting addition he proves, but it's hard to look past Andy Serkis in the role of Caesar.
Yeah, the Steve Zahn character is the comic relief in this film, which is a very serious film. It's really going for that kind of almost overwrought emotional impact. I think it just about gets there. It's interesting, the ape characters are so much more realised and fleshed out than the human characters. Mm. I mean, Woody Harrelson is the sort of antagonist in this, but he's really only in it for like a 5-minute exposition dialogue sequence.
What'd you say?
Where he basically just says what we already kind of know. He fills in the gaps, basically, because we know that this film is leading up to the original 1968 film,
right.
The events of that film. So it's kind of going back and filling in some of the science stuff that we've maybe missed. Or
does the timeline of this film, does it actually marry with the old Charlton Heston pictures?
There's a few subtle hints in this film as to the events which we, as I say, lead up to the Charlton Heston film. One character that shares a name with a character in the Charlton Heston film, but we don't know if it's the same character or kind of homage to that film. So I think there is, I think the timeline does kind of make sense. Mm. As I say, it happens. I would place this maybe sort of 20 years or so before the 1968 film.
Okay.
In the whole overarching timeline.
It sagged for you a little in the middle, you were saying. Overall, what did you think?
I think this film is, because of the CGI, because of how advanced it is, they're so confident with this film. It's really hit its stride. I mean, three films in, I've always found the concept a little bit of a stretch. That sounds strange because I'm such a big fan of the original films and have always enjoyed those. But I think with these, you know, just the image of monkeys riding around on horseback firing shotguns, for me, it's a little bit of a kind of leap in logic. I know it's a sci-fi film and everything else, but with these films, they've got to a point now where they're just so confident with it that you just believe it and you're kind of with it.
You almost don't notice.
You almost don't notice, yeah. Mm. It is a shame about the human characters, because I think you do need that like conflict. The main conflict in this film is happening with Caesar internally. Mm-hmm. I think it's a kind of moral dilemma that he's having with himself.
Okay, Manuela, thumbs up from you?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was just so beautifully realized, and I wasn't super familiar with the franchise. I hadn't seen any of the other Planet of the Apes movies until I saw that one, and then yesterday and the day before I watched Rise and Dawn. Mm-hmm. But I just find it so fascinating in how it kind of ticks all the boxes to talk about so many issues. So, you know, obviously race and class and the animal-human divide and all those things. I'm not saying it does all those things really well, or I'm not saying it's not problematic in some respects, but I remember watching that one, War for the Planet of the Apes, at some point I was just struck by how this is kind of a strange, bizarre, fantastical metaphor for decolonization, because you know,
for
once,
what, sorry?
Decolonization.
Okay.
Because once you've you know, learned the things of the people who have colonized you, you can't just get rid of them. You can't just become who you used to be, because you've never known what you used to be. Mm. Caesar's son doesn't know what it's like to be just a normal ape. So you see these apes just living as apes, but still with human-like attributes, and that's just fascinating. I'm not saying the movie really explores that in a very profound way, but it's definitely nice to see a blockbuster that makes you think about that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on in this film.
Totally, and also the quoting very, very obviously Apocalypse Now. Mm. And I remember when I was watching it, I was like, oh, this is funny. Like, it looks like Apocalypse Now. And also just in the themes, you know, the story of Woody Harrelson's character is very much like
Kurtz
in Apocalypse Now. But then it kind of gets very heavy and very on the nose, being like, in case you missed it, this is Apocalypse Now? How do we say it?
Apocalypse Now.
It's famously written on the
the wall of a tunnel.
On the temple in Apocalypse Now.
Oh, is it? Right.
Yeah,
right.
Because they didn't actually, if you watch that film, it doesn't have any opening credits.
Right.
And for a film to be passed by the Movie Picture Association in America, it has to have the title somewhere in the film, whether it's in the credits. Oh. So that's the way they got around it, was to graffiti it on the temple. So this is a sort of nod to that. But then, they've used the terrible Apocalypse Now, which everyone's used by this point.
Yeah.
And it's literally, I mean, the opening shot is evokes Vietnam imagery, because you've got these soldiers and their helmets. They have
some great helmets.
Some good graffiti. Like, I think one says something like
Bedtime for Bonzo.
Yeah, Bedtime for Bonzo, which is great. And so instantly, you know, you're like, okay, Vietnam. It does something similar with it, I think, to what Kong Skull Island did.
Right.
Repurposing that, the okay. imagery and iconography of that war.
I found that the score was incredible. The score was also just like the cinematography, kind of classical. It's by Michael Giacchino. Mm. And it was so thrilling and used very intelligently. Sometimes there was just silence and that was terrifying. I was really scared also during this movie, but... So I don't think it's really, really for kids because there's a lot of gun violence as well. But the score was so beautiful and so, so gripping.
Mm, which is another thing that marks it as a very different kind of blockbuster in that
yeah.
it is willing to use silence for so much of the film.
That's something that's so rare. And I'm always surprised at how few blockbusters understand that. Like, that's so powerful.
Funnily enough, the bit where you felt that it sagged a little bit was the bit that I most enjoyed, when it pared it down from these vast hordes of apes or humans to just five or six characters riding along on this kind of quest. And that middle section, I found really lyrical. I really enjoyed that. It's a little bit overlong, I would say, perhaps.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I would say it's worth seeing just for the technical achievement. Visually, it's just an astonishing film.
Absolutely.
Almost distractingly so. I mean, as much as... You cannot fault the CGI in this. There's certain shots. There's one shot in particular of Caesar in the rain, and the detail on his fur, on his wet fur, is just unbelievable. I still think, as impressive as it is, and this is just my love for the originals speaking here, but give me a bloke in a monkey suit any day over this.
Well, interesting. Oh. We'll be talking about a film with
a
fellow in a monkey suit later on. Matt Reeves, the director... did Cloverfield, which I really enjoyed.
And that's right.
He's down to do The Batman as and when that finally gets underway with Ben Affleck in the in the titular role. That's quite
exciting,
isn't it? Yeah.
I think that's good. Maybe they should use CGI to make The Batman instead of Ben Affleck, but I don't know. Maybe that's just my idea.
Right. Interesting. But otherwise, what score would you like to give it?
Oh, Anticipation. I would say, well, I hadn't seen any of them, but... the trailer looked amazing, so I'd say 3.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoyment, 4.5. I would say I had so much fun. And in retrospect, I'd say 4. Definitely worth seeing.
I think 3.
Okay.
And the 4 is for the wetter guys.
Right.
James, I want to know your scores.
Well, I wasn't anticipating all that much because I wasn't blown away by the first two, so probably around a 2 there. Really found it a thrilling film. 4. Afterwards, wasn't sure whether it actually said all that much, but it was a brilliant day out at the cinema because it is quite a long film. Mm. So I'll give it a kind of 3.5 in retrospect. But yeah, definitely worth seeing. Oh, up next, we'll talk about The Beguiled.
Is your leg paining you?
Some.
Well, I hear numbness would be more grave.
Indeed.
There's some brandy if you wish.
Now that would be a pleasure.
It's not being offered for your pleasure, only for your comfort.
Yes, ma'am.
I must remind you, Corporal McBurney, you are not a guest here. You are a most unwelcome visitor, and we do not propose to entertain you.
Well, I wouldn't expect it, ma'am. Although you'll find I'm easily amused.
Hey, The Beguiled. All right, Sofia Coppola at the helm here for what is remarkably only her 6th feature film in about 2 decades worth of work. All right, so Manuela, did Nicole Kidman entertain you?
Nicole Kidman was fine. Nothing wrong with her. So basically she plays this lady who's in charge of this... how would you call that?
Seminary, is it?
Seminary for girls?
Is it a seminary?
Yes. It's a girls' school.
A girls' school.
Mm. In Virginia during the Civil War. And she's staying in that school with a few other young women who have been sheltered there during the war. And everybody else is basically gone. And one day, one of the little girls finds a Union soldier wounded in the woods. And she takes him in to help him because otherwise he's going to die because of his wounded leg. But soon... the beautiful man played by Colin Farrell, Colonel McBurney, creates some sexual tensions amongst the girls and rivalries, and then
stuff happens.
Yeah.
As you say. Well, this is a story that has been told famously by the Don Siegel Clint Eastwood version, which we talked about on Film Club about a month or so ago, and it shares the source material, which is Thomas Cullinan's novel from I think 66, called, I believe, The Painted Devil. I might be wrong about that. Anyway, and what Sofia Coppola was doing here, she says, was she told that she, our very own, Sophie Monks Kaufman.
In an interview which you can read on our website, littlewhiteliars.com, right now.
She says, it's telling the same story, but from the woman's character's point of view. Does it tell you more, this film, about... Have you seen the previous version?
So I saw Coppola's, and then... I saw Coppola's in Cannes, and then a few weeks later, I saw the original at the Prince Charles Cinema on Prince. It was beautiful. I found that in Coppola's version, what she was trying to do, or maybe what she means by from the women's perspective, is that she tried to make the women look better. In a way, she tried to make them look less crazy. But then again, I think in the original, they do not look crazy. They look like women who are scared, who haven't seen a man in a long time, who have forbidden desires, and who are trying to deal with them in the best way they can. And so obviously they do strange things, but that's understandable given the circumstances. So I think, I don't know, I found Coppola's was a watered-down version of this and really not an interesting update at all.
All right. Adam, what did you think?
I'm with you a little bit on that in terms of it not necessarily doing that much different to the Don Siegel version. Although, yeah, Coppola has said this is more of an adaptation of the novel and probably represents an update on that.
I have not read the novel, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah, I think the Siegel version is possibly a little bit dated, and the characters do feel a little bit... It's quite histrionic in the depiction of certainly the not so much the young women, but the kind of young adult women in the film. In this, I think it's just a really beautiful character piece. It's quite a tight ensemble of recognisable faces in Nicole Kidman and Kirsten Dunst as well, who I think gives the best performance in this film.
She's the best by far.
Yeah, and younger actress Elle Fanning, who we've seen in The Neon Demon, who's kind of coming of age now, and young Angourie Rice as well, who's terrific in The Nice Guys. I've got to say, I really love this film.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Well, I was quite alone in my disliking of it, so, yeah.
If it's any help, Manuel, I wasn't blown away by
this.
I wasn't sure what... I was amazed when I'd heard that she decided that... when she announced she was going to do this.
Me too.
And I really didn't know what it added, except for the fact that it looks a lot more... I was going to say modern. It's actually quite classic in the way that it's put together, visually. It looks fantastic and a lot less dated than all the kind of melodramatic crash zooms and stuff that,
yeah,
that Siegel had in
psychedelic.
His original.
That's true.
So the imagery I found really, really interesting. It's a great film to look at, much as War of the Planet of the Apes, from that kind of Red Riding Hood opening scene of the girl going off to pick her mushrooms. And it's an interesting thing, that notion of who is the big bad wolf, because I actually found Colin Farrell in this version way more sympathetic and much less the fox in the hen house that Clint had been in the earlier version.
Which is such a strange thing to do, because... It is important that the guy be such a liar. Like, what's really interesting in the Siegel version is that it does that amazing thing that a few films do, for example, the original Mission Impossible, where you have a character telling a story about something that happened, and what you see is what actually happened. It's different. It does that thing in the Siegel where Clint Eastwood is saying, oh yeah, I was this great war soldier, and actually he was horrible and a coward. In this one... Coppola just got rid of all the backstory, basically, of all the characters, the guy, the girls as well. And so it's much less interesting and it's much less believable as well. So Edwina, played by Kirsten Dunst, she obviously has so much on her mind, and Kirsten's performance really translates that. But then that's based on nothing, because we have no backstory. We just have, like, oh, look at her eyes. She looks really sad. Something must have happened. But we never get to know any of this. So I don't know if I would call this a great character study, because the characters are also kind of empty and shells.
I think it's a great character study purely for Colin Farrell's character. And I feel like I have to defend this now.
Yeah, please
more
do.
More so than I might have done. But
that's more interesting.
He's quite ambiguous. He's in this sort of survival mode initially. We should say that he's sort of injured. He's sort of recovering in this girl school. His charm, he charms the women, basically. And I think his performance is quite subtle in that way. He's not over the top. He's not a kind of winking kind of ladies' man.
Yeah, he's terrific, I think.
He plays it down a little bit, and he's very easy, as I say, ambiguous in his intentions of actually what is he trying to get out of the women. Is he just trying to woo them so that they can heal him and he can stay there and see out the war? I think it's a very complex and layered performance from Colin Farrell.
I agree that he's good, and his performance is really kind of suits the film, and his character is interesting. But I just feel like not having the whole story, like the whole historical aspect, is lost as well,
right,
which is a shame because it's so important.
Which she's consciously decided to remove, which is has become a real issue in a lot of people's reaction to this film, specifically the one black character in the novel and in the Siegel version, the slave. Mm. There's an announcement that one of the characters says at the start of this film, all the slaves have left, which Sofia Coppola says, basically, I just didn't want to kind of cloud almost what I was doing with this film with a discussion of slavery and race. But it's kind of strange when you're doing a film about the Civil War not to have any kind of reflection on that at all.
Well, the novel is as much about that as anything else. And there's also a character in it who is mixed race and is living as a white woman.
Right.
And so she's an interesting counterpoint to the slave, the housemaid character. Coppola, I can see why she's done it. I think if she had retained those characters, specifically the maid character from the Don Siegel film, she would have to address that.
Mm.
And clearly she felt that she was not in a position to do so. I think...
Why would she not be in a position to do so?
In terms of the story she's trying to tell.
Yeah.
I think she probably felt that it was something that was maybe too big a topic for her to get into. I don't
right.
know. I mean, I don't want to speak before, for her, but
sure.
I think respecting an artist's decision in what the story they're trying to tell. I mean, film for what it is, kind of.
Sure, okay, because it looks fantastic. And although I wasn't wild about it, I would still say it was worth seeing because it does look fantastic. Beautifully put together, cinematographer Philippe Lesourd, is it?
Manuel? Philippe Lesourd.
Is he? I'm not familiar with
him. I do
not
know him.
Okay.
No, I'm not
but he's done a bang up job on this. Was anybody else reminded of The Others with Nicole Kidman in a house in wartime surrounded by fog?
It.
Slightly, yeah. Mm. Although, where that film is, I think, absolutely terrifying. This one I found quite funny in places. there's one particular scene, the dinner scene. Later on, which is just absolutely hysterical. I mean, that purely is down to Nicole Kidman's delivery of her dialogue. I think it had a little bit more to say, not necessarily on the Civil War or slavery or these issues, which she stripped them away, perhaps not for the best reasons. You could probably have set this film in any time or place,
right,
and have much the same story. But as a kind of film about young female coming of age, sexual awakening, and repressed sexuality as well, I think it's very interesting.
Give it some numbers, Adam.
4 for Anticipation. I like Sofia Coppola generally. Her last film, The Bling Ring, I absolutely adored. So slightly higher Anticipation than maybe otherwise. And a 4 in enjoyment, and I think a 5 in retrospect.
Really? A 5 in retrospect?
Yeah, I love this film.
Wow. Manuela, follow that.
So, Anticipation, so I'd say 4. And I also really liked her movies, especially The Virgin Suicides. Enjoyment, 2. I was really bored. And also, I felt really distressed because I could tell that everyone else was enjoying it. I was just like, what is wrong with me?
But this was in Cannes, where, of course, she won Best Director.
I know. And I'm like, I'm really glad she did. It's great. You know, women should win. And she deserves it for other films. Mm. So that's good. But not this one. And in retrospect, I'd say 2 again, because it's such a waste. It's such a missed opportunity, I feel. It just didn't happen.
I anticipated 3. I enjoyed it 2.5. And probably in retrospect, I'm thinking it looked great. I'll give it a 3. But, it's worth seeing. It's a fine piece of cinematic craft, that's for sure. Did you want to have a final word on this?
I was just going to say fair dues and love to hear listeners' thoughts on it. So
right.
People should share their scores with us on Twitter or...
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Okay. And if you like Nicole Kidman and Colin Farrell as a partnership, you can see them again soon in The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which was also at Cannes.
Yes, it was. And
that's by Yogi, what's his name?
Yorgos Lanthimos.
There we go.
Who did previously
Yogi
The Lobster.
To his friends. Yep.
And yeah, it's a very different film.
Okay. Now, next up, it's the Little White Lies Film Club, and a very special edition this week as we look back on the 1986 French film Max Mon Amour, Max My Love.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Right, some classic dialogue there from Nagata Oshima's 1986 film, Max Mon Amour, Max My Love, which we're doing because it features a person in a monkey suit, the way you like it, old school, Adam.
Yeah.
Which ties in nicely with the release of War for the Planet of the Apes this week. Oh, my word. Can I just ask, beyond that tie-in, who on earth suggested this extraordinarily bizarre film?
Well, I'm going to blame David because he's not here, but I must say, I'd never seen this before. I'd heard about it. I'd seen the VHS cover and been intrigued and known it was kind of out there. And I'm so pleased that we've done this for Film Club because I absolutely love this film.
What?
So apparently listeners were very intrigued by the clip you guys posted on the Facebook page. Daniel Pattison commented, "Is this real?" Paul Hill said, "This could be the greatest or worst film of all time." And Mark Garrett saying, "I caught this on VHS thanks to the video library at Santa Fe, New Mexico," which is random. "Rambling is hypnotic, but I regret that it's not one of Nagisa Oshima's stronger efforts. The ensuing comedy is uniquely French. Rambling's husband's reaction is quiescent."
Yeah.
So some people did see it.
Right. Okay, Adam, for anyone who didn't see this film, you lucky things, what's it about?
It's a love story between Charlotte Rampling's character Margaret and a monkey, a chimpanzee called Max. Her husband is a sort of womanizing British diplomat played by Anthony Higgins, and he notices that his wife has been playing away. So hires a private detective to find out what's going on.
Why is he womanizing? He has an affair, but she has an affair with a monkey.
Well, no, this is true, but he discovers this.
Yeah.
This all happens within the first, 2 minutes of the film. He discovers that she's taken an ape as her lover. And in fact, it delivers the immortal line. I think it's like, "Margaret, do you mean to tell me your lover is a monkey?"
And that's excellent delivery.
So thank you. The film shows its hand quite early.
Right.
And then there's a kind of love affair between these two characters. You don't know whether there's anything sexual going on. It's not necessarily implied. Initially, when I was watching it, I thought, has she previously twigged his infidelity?
Mm.
And is this
she's aware of his infidelity.
Yeah, and is this her revenge on him?
Right.
Is she essentially playing this wicked game with him, with Anthony Higgins' character?
Well, it's quite clear that she knows that he's having an affair with his co-worker.
But whether it's her just revenge on him...
I didn't get that at all. She said she saw the monkey in the zoo and their eyes met and they fell in love.
Well, so this is what I was going to say, is that the more the film goes on, the more I think the film convinces you that the love is genuine.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of comment on, ultimately, the fact that love is blind.
Is that what the comment is about? Because you've got the Edward Albee play The Goat, or Who is Sylvia, which is a similar thing, human falling in love with an animal, and essentially it's making a point about either the hypocrisy or the impossibility of trying to in any way define or legislate what is proper for a person to feel sexual impulses about and what not. But this film, I was just mystified as to why Oshima was what he was trying to do. Mm. Victoria Abril's in this film, and it struck me, imagine if Almodovar had produced this, it would have been a romp. But instead you've got this really rather dull treatment of a bizarre story. The whole thing could have been a kind of mid-80s Disney TV movie in terms of the styling and the direction. It's very, very flat. It's not particularly a comedy because it's not particularly funny. The end has become almost like a Harry and the Hendersons moment with this kind of delighted family reunion and people waving at this monkey on the roof of a Range Rover around the streets of Paris. It's so interesting that you liked it, because I absolutely did not.
The ending is a bit silly, I'll give you that. And it does feel very dated. I think the flatness, though, or the mundanity of the situation is totally intentional.
Really?
Yeah,
okay.
I agree.
I think the idea is that, you know, the husband has just accepted this character, as perhaps he wouldn't do to a human, a man that she was having an affair with. Yeah, I think it's a fascinating study of relationships and the bonds we form with each other and with animals specifically. I love this film.
Okay, I hated it. Adam loved it. Manuela.
Well, I wouldn't say I loved it, but I definitely had a really good time watching it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I thought... I'm not sure it's really about... or just about how love is blind and all that. I think it's more of a sort of strange, subdued critique of the bourgeoisie.
Okay.
In that it's this woman, Charlotte Rampling, who's obviously, you know, she has a great life in terms of possessions and money. She's married to this British diplomat, and I guess she doesn't even have a job. She just, you know, lives. And she starts to have an affair with a monkey because that's what she wants. She wants more life in her life. She wants more animation and genuine feelings.
Mm.
And there's this amazing moment where she's having dinner with friends for her birthday, and they hear the monkey in the other room, and they're like, what is this? They can't guess what animal it is from the sound, because they can guess like the races of dogs that they hear in the street, because they're bourgeois and that's what they do, they use dogs. But they can't guess what it is, so she brought him in, she brought Max in, and Max can't help himself, and he starts just like being very kind to her, like kind of caressing her, and it's really intense, and people are like, is he always like this? And it's amazing, because that's when you see her as a real woman with feelings for once. She's not just like this cold, beautifully 80s dressed woman anymore. She's like a woman with, well, it's a monkey, but it's someone who makes her feel something. So I really saw the film as this kind of critique of the bourgeoisie and how the bourgeoisie is dead inside, basically.
I also have to say, I found Charlotte Rampling absolutely insufferable. Just astonishingly smug, her performance in this film. But that might just be me again.
I think it's possibly, again, intentional, and she's very icy in this movie.
Yeah.
She doesn't show much affection outwardly to the human, the people around her.
Right.
Only really to Max. Actually, I'd just like to give a quick shout-out to Elsa Burke, who plays Max and is uncredited in this movie. And she's got a fascinating filmography, actually. She was in Return of the Jedi, very early on in her career. She also played Aslan in a TV adaptation in the 80s of The Chronicles of Narnia. She played a panda in the film Fierce Creatures.
Right.
I just think it's fascinating, these actors who make a living from performing as animals.
And then Andy Serkis came along, and nobody else can get a look in anymore.
The thing is, Andy Serkis is amazing in what he does. But if I read another interview with him where he's trying to sort of, I don't know, say, you know, talking about being in Oscar contention for his motion capture performances, I'm just...
Well, you don't feel that he should...
No.
Why not?
I think he's amazing. Look at his eyes.
It's like half of the performance is down to him and the rest of it is down to...
But, okay, John Hurt, when he did The Elephant Man, wearing huge amounts of makeup, isn't that more or less what Andy Serkis is doing here?
No, it's different. It's so much more interesting. Come on. I agree with you on this one.
But haven't we reached a level now where the capture is so faithful to what the actor's originally doing that it does, I think the phrase has been used, digital makeup. Isn't that all we're seeing? He's in digital makeup.
It's a good kind of PR spin, I think, talking about that stuff. Obviously, there's a huge amount of craft and know-how and skill that goes into this. I don't mean to downplay that or diminish that at all. I do feel that, you know, I don't know, how difficult is it really to pretend to be a monkey? I think Andy Serkis is taking that to an incredible level, but that is ultimately what he's doing.
It's not his monkey aping, if you'll excuse the expression now, that people are suggesting golden statuettes for. It's the fact that he is so much the centre, the moral heart of this film, and his performance effectively carries, in a very, very subtle and underplayed way. Now, whether you think that's actually the Weta programmers who've put that together or whether it's what he's given them as raw material, I guess, is the question here. But I think it's a tremendously powerful performance from what is essentially a bit of CGI. I think it's really interesting what he's done here.
It's amazing.
It's way beyond just being a monkey.
I think it's the character that he plays is very human-like, so the performance is very human-like, so we can treat it as an actor performing.
Yeah.
It's not just a guy pretending to be an ape at all.
Go and see War for the Planet of the Apes, and as Adam was suggesting, do let us know what you think. And by all means, if you can track down a copy, watch Max Monomore if you haven't already. What are we going to be suggesting for people to have a look at for Film Club next week, Adam?
So next week, the big release is Dunkirk, Christopher Nolan's World War II epic. And we thought it would be nice to revisit an old British, loosely war-themed classic called A Matter of Life and Death, a Powell and Pressburger film from 1946. David Niven is the star. It's a film which I think has some thematic overlaps with Christopher Nolan's work in terms of what it talks about with time and purgatory and some of these other themes. So, yeah, that's what we're going to revisit.
So that's A Matter of Life and Death, Adam?
Yeah, and I should quickly say it's got an alternate title. I think in the US it was released as Stairway to Heaven.
Really?
So if you're searching for it, it's possibly listed as that on IMDb. But anyway, it's very called A Matter of Life and Death.
That's a fabulous choice. Hello to you, Laura Yule, which may not be how you pronounce your name, but you're in Melbourne. And you really enjoyed our film club offering so far, particularly Animal Kingdom. And you want to say happy birthday to your husband, Ian. And she'd like to nominate for future film clubs Calvary, What Macy Knew, or Control, not the Ian Curtis one, but the one with the K and two L's.
Yeah, good suggestions. I think we'll add those to the list.
Do send us your thoughts anyway. truthandmovies@tcolondon.com is the email address. Twitter @LW. Lies. I'm really looking forward to Dunkirk next week.
Me too.
You haven't seen it yet?
No. Okay. I was just going to give a quick mention to the fact that our interview with Big Chris is up online.
Oh, right.
Currently.
So was he nice?
You can read that. David actually interviewed him.
Right.
I went on a bit of a jolly to Dunkirk earlier this year, after the production, but before the kind of media train had sort of picked up. We took a helicopter trip to Dunkirk from a helipad in Battersea.
Well, they flew you to Dunkirk in a helicopter?
Yeah, which was bizarre. It took about 45 minutes. It was
as part of some kind of press junket.
It was a very small press junket. We sort of walked along the beach, got sandblasted for a little bit. Wonderful historian who I think consulted on the film talked us through the events of the time and how they recreated it. The beach is unbelievable. It's very kind of stark and long, and it's amazing to place yourself there and think of what it must have been like at the time.
Right.
Then we flew back and did a bit of a junket interview. I spoke to Harry Styles and a few of the cast. So you can read that in our latest print edition as well, which is out now.
Wow, it's such an iconic event in certainly from an English point of view, Manuel. What kind of resonance does it have in France?
Oh yeah, it's definitely really important. You know, in France we learn a lot about the war at school every year, and we get told those stories over and over again. And at the time, you might think, you know, when you're young, that you don't understand why. But then I realize how important it is, and I'm really grateful that we learn of them.
Absolutely. It seems almost like a forgotten age until you realise that Tainted Love by Soft Cell was released closer to the end of the Second World War than it is to the present day.
Wow.
That is shocking, isn't it?
I mean, yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, looking forward to Dunkirk. And what else are we doing next week?
Doing a film called City of Ghosts.
Which is?
Which is a new documentary released by the always interesting and brilliant Dogwoof. And it was in Sheffield Dockfest earlier this year and was quite a big kind of talking point film there, I think. So, yeah.
Well, that's all coming up next week then. Very soon, well, in September, the 13th of September, in fact, Wednesday the 13th of September at 7 p.m, we'll be doing our first ever live Truth and Movies. This is going to be at the London Podcast Festival, which is at King's Place, near King's Cross.
Yep.
And it's going to be featuring live shows from all sorts of other podcasts. But most importantly, Truth and Movies will be live doing its thing. So that's great.
Yeah, very excited for that. And I think tickets are already available for
they
that.
They are available. You're absolutely right. At the King's Place website now. Excellent. All right. Well, that's it for this edition. Thanks ever so much for listening. Manuela, lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you as well.
And lovely to see you again, Adam.
Pleasure as always.
And thanks for being with us, listeners. We'll be back next week. For now, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.